15. Potsdam, Germany, July 25, 1945, late evening. President Harry Truman is homesick. On the road for almost 2 weeks, he has maintained his normal routine of rising early and enjoying a breakfast of oatmeal, orange juice, toast, and milk. Yet he misses his wife Bess and the things that make a home, like his favorite White House dinner of chicken and dumplings. But right now, food is not on Truman's mind. He is immersed in his journal, penning his notes on the Potsdam Conference. The reports of Trinity's power have disturbed him, allowing the president to see at last that America possesses an unparalleled weapon of war. "We have discovered the most terrible formula in the history of the world," Truman writes with his barely legible handwriting. "It may be the fire destruction prophesied in the Euphrates Valley era, after Noah and his fabulous ark." The words flow quickly onto the page, but each is chosen with care. For good or bad, Truman knows that history will long judge this journal entry. It was only yesterday that he authorized the dropping of atomic bombs on Japan. After conferring with his military advisors and with Winston Churchill in Potsdam just before noon on July 24, 1945, Truman has allowed the process to move forward. It was a fairly easy decision, despite the objections of some nuclear scientists at Los Alamos, and even General Dwight Eisenhower, Truman's top commander in Europe, who believes that Japan is close to surrendering. In the end, Truman came to the conclusion that an invasion would cost too many American lives. Though he will later state that the final decision of where and when to use the atomic bomb was up to me, let there be no mistake about it. The truth is that the decision was made long ago by Franklin Roosevelt, who had no qualms whatsoever about the prospect of using the atomic bomb. FDR was so fed up with the death and destruction in Europe and the Pacific that he had little hesitation in justifying the $2 billion Manhattan Project. Nonetheless, Truman is the one man in the world with the power to stop the bombing of Japan, and he chooses not to do so. He issues no verbal or written order to announce his decision. Truman does nothing more than get out of the way. What will happen, will happen. It is a rare display of passive behavior by a man so prone to action, but his thinking is clear. It is late in the night as Truman continues his journal entry in Potsdam. "This weapon is to be used against Japan between now and August 10th. I have told the Secretary of War, Mr. Stimson, to use it so that military objectives and soldiers and sailors are the target, not women and children. Even if the Japs are savages, ruthless, merciless and fanatic, we, as the leader of the world for the common welfare, cannot drop this terrible bomb on the old capital or the new." The decision to spare the modern capital of Tokyo and the nearby port of Yokohama has made it almost inevitable that Hiroshima will be attacked first. The waterfront city of 350,000 has not once been firebombed, making it a prime, unscathed target. Many of its residents are Japanese soldiers and Marines. The port itself is one of the nation's largest military supply depots. Truman's insistence on military targets makes Hiroshima a natural bullseye for the bomb known as Little Boy, which has just reached the island of Tinian and is being unloaded from the USS Indianapolis at this very moment. And with Truman's refusal to destroy the ancient Japanese capital city of Kyoto, the city of Nagasaki is added to the target list in its place. "The target will be a purely military one, and we will issue a warning statement asking the Japs to surrender and save lives," Truman writes. "I'm sure they will not do that, but we will have given them the chance. It is certainly a good thing for the world that Hitler's crowd or Stalin's did not discover this atomic bomb. It seems to be the most terrible thing ever discovered, but it can be made the most useful." Although it has been more than a week since the successful A-bomb explosion in New Mexico, Truman still had not yet shared the news with Joseph Stalin. Now that the targets have been finalized, the Soviets are to be informed. The revelation to Stalin comes at the end of another frustrating day of debate about the shape of the post-war world. Russia's bargaining position is to relentlessly demand more control over territories it has seized in Europe. The U.S. position is to refuse Russian expansion. The Soviets now have more than 1 million men on the Manchurian border, poised to attack Japanese occupying forces. The presence of such a large Soviet force in China means that the Soviets will soon want a considerable say in the future of Asia. It is a tiresome negotiation, yet Truman has stood up to the Soviets time and again, refusing to allow Stalin to occupy more territory. The ornate Great Hall of the Cecilienhof Palace is sweltering. For reasons of decorum, the president will not remove his double-breasted suit coat or even loosen his bow tie. Throughout the afternoon, 15 leaders and diplomats sit around the 10-foot-wide circular conference table with Joseph Stalin to Truman's far right and Winston Churchill to his left. This summit meeting marks the first time Truman and Stalin have met in person. Over the course of the negotiations, the president has been uncowed by the Russian leader, who prefers to wear a military uniform and answers most questions with a simple grunt. This habit amuses Truman, even though he is well aware of Stalin's barbarity. Shortly before 5 p.m., the meeting ends. At the conclusion of a long afternoon around the bargaining table, Truman rises from his seat and walks 5 chairs to his right, where Stalin stands to stretch his legs. Casually, so as not to alarm the Russian leader, Truman quietly informs Stalin that the United States has a new weapon of unusual destructive force. Stalin pauses, then says through his interpreter, "I am glad to hear it." The truth is, Stalin already knows about the atomic bomb thanks to his spies inside the Los Alamos research facility. "I hope you will make good use of it against the Japanese," the Russian dictator says, and makes his exit. Almost immediately, Truman is confronted by Churchill, who is confused, as is Truman's interpreter Charles Bolin, a Soviet expert and American diplomat. Secretary of State James F. Burns joins them. The men can't believe Stalin is so indifferent. In fact, Joseph Stalin is panicked. He is a man for whom total power is everything, and the idea that his military might could be diminished is intolerable. Joseph Stalin has murdered millions of his own citizens and has allowed his troops to loot and pillage Germany and Eastern Europe. His goal is to dominate the world. He is terrified that this new weapon will shift the balance of power in favor of the Americans. Footnote: estimates of the number of people killed by Stalin range from as low as 20 million to as high as 62 million unnatural deaths during Stalin's time as Soviet leader. The man who is credited with saying that death solves all problems and one death is a tragedy, 1 million is a statistic, murdered his own citizens through executions, artificial famines, forced labor camps, incarceration, and torture. End footnote. After leaving the Great Hall of Cecilienhof Palace, Stalin quickly dictates a telegram to the scientists at work on Russia's own nuclear program. Hurry with the job. 16. Manila City Hall, Manila, Philippines, July 30, 1945, 15:15 hours. The most powerful man in the Pacific has no idea the atomic bomb is operational and that massive destruction is just days away. At the Potsdam Conference, President Truman's military advisors now know about Trinity, as do Britain and Russia's top generals. In Germany, American General Dwight Eisenhower, commander of all Allied forces in Europe, was informed of the nuclear weapon's success over dinner 1 week ago. "They told me they were going to drop it on the Japanese," Eisenhower will later write. "I was against it on 2 counts. First, the Japanese were ready to surrender, and it wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. Second, I hate to see our country being the first to use such a weapon." But General Douglas MacArthur, the most senior officer on either side of the war, a man who has served under 8 presidents, who has been awarded a Medal of Honor and commands a territory 5 times the size of the United States, with more than 1 million fighting men at his order, has been told nothing. Even as his staff continues to prepare for the invasion of Japan, an event Douglas MacArthur believes will result in 1 million casualties, the general lives a life of leisure. He spends his days regaling with war stories the reporters and delegates from Washington who have come to the Philippines to pay their respects, and enjoys long lunches at Casablanca, the mansion he has appropriated for his family amidst the devastation of Manila. On this sweltering Monday afternoon, another delegation fills his second-floor office. The guests include Assistant Secretary of the Navy H. Struva Hensel and Vice Admiral Ross T. McIntyre, who until very recently served as Franklin Roosevelt's personal physician. Their manner is deferential, befitting the respect due a commander of MacArthur's stature. While his guests remain seated, the general paces the room and thinks out loud throughout their visit, as is his custom. MacArthur's top staff, who admire him tremendously, sometimes mimic this behavior to add a little levity to their day. As the 30-minute meeting winds to a polite conclusion and the 5-man delegation is ushered out the door, MacArthur has a few brief moments to reflect on the shocking news that landed on his desk yesterday. Japanese troops are pouring onto the island of Kyushu with no end in sight. Footnote: American forces captured Japanese code books during the battles for Iwo Jima and Okinawa, allowing intelligence units based in Pearl Harbor to read top-secret enemy documents. Operation Magic is the code name for the program whose focus is decrypting Japanese messages. The men who decode them call themselves magicians. End footnote. Instead of the 80,000 soldiers MacArthur believed would be defending the invasion beaches, 9 Japanese divisions comprising more than 500,000 men are now digging in on the coastline, waiting for the Americans to land. Almost all are stationed at Kyushu's southern beaches, site of MacArthur's Operation Olympic invasion zones. MacArthur is troubled. Allied forces now control most of the Pacific, as MacArthur demonstrated by wading ashore during the invasion of Borneo just a few weeks ago. But the Japanese still own much of Asia's Pacific Rim. Their air force bases in Korea, China, and northern Japan will allow them to launch kamikaze aircraft against an invasion fleet. In addition, the Imperial Japanese Navy's 12th Flotilla, based on Kyushu, has 900 hidden planes that will be utilized for suicide flights. Vintage wooden biplanes, invisible to American radar, are also being retrofitted for nighttime suicide attacks. Just as menacing, employees at the Sasebo Naval Station near Nagasaki are working double shifts to build special suicide boats designed to ram landing craft laden with U.S. soldiers. The Japanese believe they know precisely where American troops will invade, so vast underground caves are being constructed behind the beaches and stocked with food and ammunition. All civilians are being forcibly removed from the southward-facing coastal regions so that barbed wire, artillery batteries, mines, and anti-tank defenses can be installed and camouflaged. As MacArthur continues reading the shocking report, he realizes that the enemy is changing the tactical and strategic situation sharply. No longer will the Japanese utilize the Fukaku strategy employed on Peleliu, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa, lying in wait to repel the American attack from hidden defensive bunkers. Now it is clear to MacArthur that they will defend the beaches with even more fury than the Germans guarded the D-Day landing zones within France. The sands of Kyushu could very well become an American graveyard. To MacArthur's way of thinking, there are 3 ways for America to knock out Japan: a naval blockade followed by an invasion, a naval blockade followed by massive aerial bombing, or a straight-up beach invasion. As an army officer and a general committed to commanding the largest military force in history, MacArthur refuses to concede that the Navy and the Army Air Corps should determine the outcome of the war. Paranoid by nature, creating conflicts where they might not otherwise exist, MacArthur thinks the other 2 services are aligned in a conspiracy to prevent his army from getting the glory. Foolishly, MacArthur is openly antagonistic to Admiral Chester Nimitz, his naval equal in rank and power, calling his tactical strategies just awful. The Navy, MacArthur believes, wants to control all overseas positions after the war, using the Army as a sort of home guard. Nonetheless, he needs the sailors and flyboys. The cornerstones of Operation Olympic are the ongoing pre-invasion aerial bombardment of Japan's industrial sector and the obliteration of Japan's navy by an American fast carrier task force. After that, MacArthur's 6th Army will deliver the decisive blow with its landing on Kyushu. The general is not a man prone to histrionics, commanding instead with an air of quiet authority. He has confided in friends that he believes the Japanese will surrender by September 1st, but the new report indicates that the enemy is spoiling for a fight. It also puts the timing of Operation Olympic in grave danger. MacArthur cannot attack for 4 to 5 months at the earliest, giving the Japanese even more time to prepare. Footnote: An invasion is more than just the act of sending men ashore. Soldiers need to be fed, armed, and cared for in case of injury. MacArthur was awaiting the arrival of troops from Europe, as well as stockpiling weapons, ammunition, landing vessels, food, and hospital supplies. End footnote. The confident tone of other recently intercepted Japanese communiques makes one thing certain. The enemy's determination to slaughter Americans will only increase during this lull. Proof of Japan's determination to kill Americans even when all seems lost lies 100 feet deep in the Pacific, 600 miles from Manila. Lieutenant Commander Mochitsuru Hashimoto eats a fragrant dinner of fresh onions and canned sweet potatoes while plotting the submarine's next maneuver. The Japanese commander is discouraged, but far from beaten. The galley, like the rest of the cramped sub, smells of unwashed men, stale breath, and cooked fish. A sauna-like humidity fills the hull in these equatorial waters, leading Hashimoto's crew to sleep naked on sacks of rice in an attempt to ward off the heat. Hashimoto has deliberately positioned his vessel in the middle of the busy shipping lanes between Guam and the Philippines. But despite daily prayers at his makeshift Shinto altar, the gods have not yet blessed Hashimoto. It seemed he might be in luck yesterday when I-58 launched 2 Kaiten torpedoes after sighting an American cargo ship and its destroyer escort. But the armed freighter, Wild Hunter, opened fire with her deck guns, sinking the first torpedo and killing its pilot. The second Kaiten was rammed by the destroyer Lowry and blown to bits. There was little damage to the U.S. warship. More critically, that missed opportunity has turned Hashimoto from the hunter to the hunted. The American destroyer Albert T. Harris is currently prowling the same corridor through which I-58 sails, searching for the source of a periscope spotted by the Wild Hunter's crew. Midway through I-58's one-month mission, running out of fuel and food, Hashimoto knows he must turn back for Japan very soon. With every passing day of failure, Hashimoto increasingly despairs that he will not get his kill. 13 miles from the Japanese submarine in the dark of night, the USS Indianapolis steams toward the Philippines, having dropped her atomic cargo at Tinian Island 3 days ago. The sea churns. Thin clouds drape the moon. Despite the late hour, the heat in the windowless sleeping compartments below decks is too intense for many of the crew. 300 sailors have made their beds on the hard steel deck, unprotected from the elements and anything else that may come their way tonight. Weary from the day, Captain Charles McVeigh takes one last walk around Indianapolis before turning in. 3 hours ago, content that his ship and men were not in imminent danger, he ordered that the ship's anti-submarine zigzag pattern of motion be ceased to increase sailing speed. He also ordered that hatches and doors remain open, letting in the nighttime air. In the event of an attack, these compartments will flood quickly, but McVeigh has received no intelligence reports suggesting that enemy submarines are lurking in this portion of the Pacific. The fact that he was not assigned a destroyer escort for this 2-day journey further convinces him that his men are safe. Broad-chested and tall, McVeigh stoops as he enters his small cabin just off the bridge, strips off his clothes, and lies down for the night. 3 days ago, his men offloaded cargo that they had no idea was, in fact, the atomic bomb known as Little Boy. Immediately afterward, Indianapolis was ordered to sail with all due haste to Leyte in the Philippines for 2 weeks of training. McVeigh himself would not later be angry that he was denied information about the atomic bomb. In that way, he would never struggle with the moral or ethical dilemma of transporting the most lethal weapon in the history of man 6,000 miles across the Pacific, there to be loaded in the bomb bay of the world's most powerful airplane and dropped on a city of 350,000 men, women, and children. Sweating in the darkness, Captain McVeigh tries his best to sleep. His ship is due to dock on Leyte at 1100 hours. His mind is focused on the 17 days of training awaiting Indianapolis in the Philippines. After being away from the war for 4 months, his men will go through a series of refresher courses to get them battle-ready. Once that training is completed, Indianapolis will sail for Okinawa, there to await the beginning of Operation Olympic. Midnight. Sunday night becomes Monday morning. Far below decks in the ship's galley, dishes are washed and stacked in preparation for breakfast. Incredibly, the sounds of preparation are heard 13 miles away on board the Japanese submarine I-58. As Captain McVeigh drifts into a fitful sleep in his Spartan cabin, the rattle of clinking dishes alerts a Japanese sonar operator that the USS Indianapolis is target ready. Quickly, Lieutenant Commander Hashimoto gives the order to load 6 lethal torpedoes. The seas are too rough to launch Kaiten suicide bombers, so he chooses to fire conventional Type 95 torpedoes. It is better this way. The Kaiten are unpredictable in rough seas. The Type 95, on the other hand, is the best torpedo in the world, armed with the largest warhead on either side of the conflict, with an effective range of more than 6 miles. Hashimoto orders the sub to surface, allowing him to scan the horizon and flood the dank confines of the vessel with fresh air. To the lieutenant commander's shock, his unsuspecting target is running in a straight line and unprotected by an escort vessel. Rather than hurry the attack, Hashimoto patiently levels his vessel at 60-foot depth and slows her speed. For 20 heart-pounding minutes, I-58 edges closer to Indianapolis. Hashimoto expects to be discovered at any time, believing the enemy ship has sonar devices that will detect his approach. But this is not the case. Even though Indianapolis was retrofitted with the most up-to-date equipment during her recent repairs in San Francisco, the technology to hear sounds underwater and detect imminent threats was not installed. A situation that proves fatal. Footnote. There are conflicting theories as to why sonar was not installed. The most convincing is that the Navy was in a rush to put the Indianapolis back to sea. End footnote. Hashimoto slows I-58 to 3 knots. Calmly, knowing that he will get just one chance to sink this American ship, Hashimoto brings his sub to within 1,500 yards of his target. The cold-blooded job of the wartime submariner is to sink enemy ships, but the harsh reality is that the attackers may also be sent to a watery grave. Submarine warfare is the most lethal on Earth. In the German Navy, for example, 80% of all submariners never returned home. The Japanese fatality rate is lower, but not by much. Also, it is not the job of the attacking submarine to rescue survivors in the water. That task is left for other vessels that might be in the vicinity. As soon as torpedoes are launched at an enemy ship, the submarine dives as quickly as possible to escape. At 12:02 a.m., Hashimoto decides it is time to kill. "Full salvo," he orders. "2-second intervals. Fire!" A look through his periscope shows that Indianapolis is still taking no evasive action. 6 torpedoes purr silently through the water, on course to slam broadside into the American ship. Hashimoto maintains his vigil at the periscope, wondering if the attack will be a success or yet another failure. Minute upon minute passes. He sees nothing but inky blackness. Then, suddenly, the sky turns bright orange. "A hit! A hit!" Hashimoto shouts to the men crowded around the periscope. Throughout the submarine, the I-58's crew dances with joy. Tonight they will feast on rice and boiled eel as a reward for a job well done. Lieutenant Commander Mochitsura Hashimoto finally has a kill. Shock envelops the Indianapolis. The lead torpedo blasts a hole in the starboard side of the bow. The engine room, powering the ship's mighty propellers, screws in Navy parlance, is not yet hit, and the vessel keeps pushing forward at a speed of 17 knots. This causes ocean water to pour into the gaping wound like a torrential river, racing through open compartments and instantly flooding the forward portion of the ship. radio operators immediately send SOS signals, alerting any vessels in the vicinity that Indianapolis needs help. "We are torpedoed and sinking fast," the desperate radio operators add to the standard SOS dots and dashes. "We need immediate assistance." Footnote. In Morse code, this is a system of 3 dots, 3 dashes, then 3 more dots. End footnote. The distress calls abruptly end when a second torpedo strikes within an instant of the first, tearing a hole in the right side of the ship and exploding 3,000 pounds of aviation fuel. That cuts the electrical power necessary to send further emergency messages. Hundreds of men are killed instantly, many of them burned beyond recognition. In his cabin just off the bridge, Captain Charles McVeigh quickly throws on a pair of shorts and walks out to inspect the damage. Thick smoke and the almost total blackness of the dark night prevent him from seeing much. At first, the skipper is actually relieved, believing that the blow to his ship is less brutal than the damage Indianapolis suffered off Okinawa. So it is that when Lieutenant K.C. Moore, the damage control officer, informs McVeigh that the forward compartments are flooded and his ship is going down, the captain does not believe him. 3 minutes later, that changes. Second-in-command, Executive Officer Joseph Flynn, delivers a harsh dose of reality. "I think we are finished," he informs McVeigh. "I recommend we abandon ship." The captain is stunned. This, a devastating personal blow to the unblemished record of this career naval officer. The Indianapolis is a significant command, the vessel so highly thought of that she was once the flagship of the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. Even though McVeigh was denied the destroyer escort from Guam to Leyte that could have mitigated the attack, he will now have to answer as to why he compounded the mistake by stopping the defensive zigzag sailing pattern and opening all the ship's hatches in hostile waters. But right now, Captain Charles McVeigh III must set aside his own emotions and focus on saving the lives of his men. 8 minutes after the torpedoes hit, the Indianapolis lists 18 degrees to starboard and leans more to the side with every passing second. Reluctantly, McVeigh orders Commander Flynn, "Give the order to abandon ship." But that order is never delivered to the men. Indianapolis is without electricity, and the ship's bugler does not follow the order to sound the command. By 12:17 a.m., Indianapolis is listing 60 degrees, little more than 10 minutes after the first strike. The bow of the ship has been sheared off, just like you had taken a saw and cut it off clean, in the words of one junior officer. Many of the sailors panic, forgetting to don life jackets as they leap into the thick coat of oil now covering the water. They swim frantically, desperate to put distance between themselves and the sinking ship, knowing that Indianapolis will suck them into the depths as she goes down, if they are too close. "I started to walk forward to see what I could see, and what I seen was about 60 feet of the bow chopped off, completely gone," sailor Woody James will recall. "Within a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes at the most, the bow is starting to go down. It filled up with water that fast. Everything was open below deck, and the water just flooded in, and we were still underway, just scooping water. Complete chaos, total and complete chaos all over the whole ship. Screams like you couldn't believe, and nobody knew what was going on." Of her crew of 1,196, more than 800 men make it into the sea. The military foul-up that saw an extra shipment of life jackets delivered to Indianapolis back in San Francisco now seems like an act of providence. But of the ship's 35 life rafts, only a dozen are launched because as the ship rolls to its side, the other rafts become inaccessible. Captain Charles McVeigh is one of the last to leave Indianapolis. He stands on what used to be a vertical section of the port hull, then walks into the water like a man stepping off a curb to cross the street. McVeigh looks back and sees his ship rise straight up into the air. Her propellers spin slowly, silhouetted by the moon. Then the 10,000-ton cruiser knifes straight to the bottom of the Pacific. The survivors are disoriented. Moments ago they were sleeping, dreaming of the things men dream of when the end of a war is near and the return home is inevitable. Now, many are burned and maimed from the blasts. They bob helplessly in the darkness, their bodies rising and lowering on the heavy swell. No longer a crew, they drift off in small packs borne by the current. Knowing that they are due in the Philippines by morning, most men are confident of rescue when it is clear they are overdue. But the SOS that should save them has not been heard. No one knows the Indianapolis has been sunk, and there is no search underway for the surviving sailors. The situation seems like it can't get any worse. Then the sharks appear. 2 days after the Indianapolis sinks, General Carl Tui Spots arrives in Manila to meet secretly with General Douglas MacArthur. The newly appointed commander of United States Army Strategic Air Forces in the Pacific, USASTAF, has been flying for most of the last 5 days, traveling 8,500 miles from Washington to Manila. Spots is not here of his own volition, but because he was ordered to brief MacArthur by the acting Army Chief of Staff, General Thomas Handy. Footnote: Handy was serving in that capacity while General George C. Marshall was in Potsdam with President Truman. End footnote. A man of average height with an Errol Flynn-type mustache, the 54-year-old Spots was present in Rheims, France, when the Germans surrendered on May 7, 1945, and is now posted to the Pacific to facilitate a similar situation for the Japanese. But his first order of business will be ensuring the deployment of the atomic bomb. Handy gave Spots the order verbally, but Spots refused to take the assignment unless given instructions in writing. "Listen, Tom," Spots told Handy, aware that he could be tried for war crimes if held personally liable for the loss of life that would ensue. "If I'm going to kill 100,000 people, I'm not going to do it on verbal orders. I want a piece of paper." Handy protested that putting such an order in writing compromised security. Even Harry Truman had refused to affix his signature to any order connecting him with the dropping of the A-bomb. But Spots insisted. Finally, Handy caved. "I guess I agree, Tui," the acting chief of staff admitted. "If a fellow thinks he might blow up the whole end of Japan, he ought to have a piece of paper." Handy signed the order, but it was actually written by General Leslie Groves of the Manhattan Project. It is perhaps the most important directive in world history. Once satisfied that his posterior was covered, Spots endured a grueling journey via military transport from Washington, D.C., to Honolulu, to Guam, and now to MacArthur's corner office in Manila. There has been nothing comfortable about these flights aboard lumbering military transport planes, whose engines drone so loudly that men cannot speak without shouting, and where sleep is only secured sitting up, numbered in minutes instead of hours. Yet General Spots barely rested after reaching his new headquarters in Guam, even though the luxury of a villa and the comfort of a horizontal bed awaited. The career aviator pressed on, increasing the length of his journey by another 2 days in order to meet with MacArthur in person. There is a purpose to his haste. He wants MacArthur to know about the atomic bomb before it is dropped. As Groves later comments, "If the weather had been suitable, the bomb would have been dropped before MacArthur had ever been informed by Spots, which would have been quite surprising to MacArthur." Spots, a man known for his curt speech pattern and matter-of-fact planning, is weary as he greets MacArthur. His body is not used to the tropical heat. He sweats through his uniform. And yet the weight of what he must tell the general compels him so much that he cannot rest until he hands the A-bomb order to a man whose legendary status will soon earn him the nickname Caesar of the Pacific. For a moment, the two men speak casually. Then Spots hands MacArthur the order. "I didn't try to explain it," Spots will later recall. "I just handed it to him and thought that he would ask me lots of questions. But instead, he talked about that letter for about 5 minutes, and the rest of the hour proceeded to expound the theories of atomic energy to me." The order begins specifically. "The first special bomb will be dropped as soon after about August 3, 1945, as weather will permit visual bombing on one of the targets, Hiroshima, Kokura, Niigata, and Nagasaki. Secondly, additional bombs will be delivered on the above targets as soon as made ready by the project staff. Further instructions will be issued concerning targets other than those listed above." The third clause is a warning. Discussion of any and all information concerning the use of the weapon against Japan is reserved to the Secretary of War and the President of the United States. No communiques on the subject or releases of information will be issued by commanders in the field without specific prior authority. Any news stories will be sent to the War Department for specific clearance. The fourth and final directive of the order includes one caveat targeted specifically at spots. It is desired that you personally deliver one copy of this directive to General MacArthur and one copy to Admiral Nimitz for their information. Nimitz, whose Pacific Fleet is headquartered in Guam, has already read the order. So it is that General Douglas MacArthur is the last to know about Japan's doom. He scribbles his initials, MACA, in the right margin to verify that he has received the one-page document. The general is not alone among U.S. military leaders in initially opposing the bomb. Generals Hap Arnold and Dwight Eisenhower have gone on record in top-secret circles as objecting, as have Admiral William D. Lay, Rear Admiral Louis L. Strauss, Assistant Secretary of War John L. McCloy, and Assistant Secretary of the Navy Ralph A. Bard. The consensus of these men is that the atomic bomb is too destructive and too many civilians will be killed. Those in favor of the A-bomb attack, such as Secretary of War Henry Stimson and Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall, are more closely tied to the White House than actual combat operations in the field. But MacArthur's displeasure runs much deeper than that of the other dissenters. The general is a brilliant tactician. He also has a deep understanding of Japanese culture, believing that the nation will never completely cooperate with surrender and an ensuing national occupation unless Emperor Hirohito is allowed to remain in power after the war ends. But there is a harsher truth. MacArthur is so determined to command Operation Olympic that he has lied about projected casualties to Marshall. In a June 17th cable to the general, meant for the eyes of President Harry Truman, he assured them that losses would be less than 100,000 men. "Your message arrived with 30 minutes to spare," Marshall cabled back to MacArthur, having received the erroneous estimate just before a big meeting with Truman, and had determining influence in obtaining formal presidential approval for Olympic. But now, Operation Olympic will never happen. Douglas MacArthur understands that his dream of conquering the nation of Japan by leading a ground invasion is over. This is a cruel blow for MacArthur. Convinced of his own military genius, MacArthur has openly disparaged fellow Army generals Dwight Eisenhower and George Patton, stating that they made every mistake that supposedly intelligent men could make. In an interview with the New York Herald Tribune in November 1944, MacArthur went on to say, "The European strategy was to hammer stupidly against the enemy's strongest points. With just a portion of the force given to Patton in North Africa, MacArthur bragged that he could have retaken the Philippines in 3 months." General Douglas MacArthur does not want to bomb the Japanese. He wants to crush them up close and personal. To his mind, that kind of victory would make him immortal. As Douglas MacArthur digests the news about the atomic bomb, sailors of the USS Indianapolis are dying. It is day 4 in the sea for them. The men are blinded by the daytime sun, desperate for food and water. Many are burned, and others are coated in oil from the massive slick that now spreads across more than 20 square miles of the Pacific. Almost all have swallowed oil and seawater thanks to the rolling swells. Dehydration is making men hallucinate, causing them to see ships, planes, islands, and even hotels that do not exist. In their thirst, some of the crew seal their own fates by drinking seawater. The salt makes them delirious before eventually causing them to slip into comas. American planes have flown over the Indianapolis victims several times, but despite the crew's best efforts to wave their arms and make themselves visible, they have not been seen. Captain Charles McVeigh is fortunate, having secured a spot in a raft rather than floating in a life jacket. He once commanded a warship with a crew of 1,200, but now his authority is limited to a rectangular raft and a handful of men who still revere him as their skipper. Within hours of the sinking, hungry sharks added to the horror. The day wore on and the sharks were around, hundreds of them, Sailor Woody James later remembered. You'd hear guys scream, especially late in the afternoon. Seemed like the sharks were the worst late in the afternoon than they were during the day. Then they fed at night, too. Everything would be quiet, and then you'd hear somebody scream, and you knew a shark had got him. A massive shark with a white dorsal fin has made Captain Charles McVeigh's raft his focus, swimming underneath it and circling. Rather than focus on the danger, McVeigh maintains hope by using a small hook and length of line from the emergency kit to fish, firing a flare gun to alert passing airplanes, and doing his best to calm the men aboard his life raft. As for the sailors in the water, McVeigh can do nothing. They are a collection of floating groups and individuals spread out over miles of open ocean. On the first night, light winds blow men in rafts northeast, away from the Philippines, even as ocean currents push those in life jackets in the opposite direction. Now, on the fourth day since their ship sank, two-thirds of these floating men are already dead. Those who remain alive are enduring torture. At first, some sailors killed each other while fighting over buoyancy vests. But now, so many men are dead that there are life jackets to spare. The current has carried the men far from the Indianapolis's resting place. Some sailors have drifted more than 50 miles. All across the sea, dead men bob on the surface. Many corpses are just torsos, the legs and lower bodies already eaten away by sharks. Other men are still alive, but some have given up hope that help will arrive. A few commit suicide by slipping out of their life vests and descending into the ocean. One sailor counts 25 shark attacks on his group. Another counts 88. So far from land, the ocean is a clear blue. In daytime, the sailors can look beneath them and see the predators circling below. There is no logic to the shark attacks, with one exception. Sailors who eat the spam rations in the emergency kit are hit first, the sharks attracted to the smell of the salty meat product. But the reality is that no one is safe. The tactic of holding absolutely still when a shark is spotted seems no more or less effective than splashing the water and making a commotion to drive it away. The sharks are relentless, no matter what the terrified sailors do. On the fourth day in the ocean, time is running out. Only Providence can save the remaining men. It does. 4 days after the Indianapolis disappears beneath the waves, Brigadier General Bill Ritchie lingers in Douglas MacArthur's office as yet another delegation from America finishes paying its respects. MacArthur's schedulers have cryptically informed their boss that Ritchie will remain behind for a short chat. Ritchie is a 43-year-old Arkansas native and West Point graduate who has just flown 6,000 miles to the Philippines from the Potsdam Conference in Germany. Like General Spots 2 days ago, he is weary from the long hours of travel that have taken him a fourth of the way around the world in the hold of a cargo plane. Soon it is just Ritchie and MacArthur in the general's office. The two men know each other well, having worked together in the past. The door is closed. A tropical breeze wafts in from the balcony. In calm, lucid tones, the easygoing Ritchie confirms that Douglas MacArthur knows about the atomic bomb. He also confirms that the bombing may take place as soon as tomorrow. The Indianapolis rescue operation begins by accident. PV-1 bomber pilot Wilbur G. Gwynn left his base on Peleliu on the morning of August 2nd in search of enemy submarines. Instead, a surprised Lieutenant Gwynn radios back to his base that he has found many men in the water. A PBY-5A Catalina is immediately dispatched to investigate the findings. The pilot is 28-year-old Lieutenant R. Adrian Marks, a man who has been part of the war in the Pacific since its very first day when he survived the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. As Marks flies to the scene, he alerts the destroyer USS Cecil J. Doyle about his emergency mission. Immediately, the Cecil J. Doyle changes its course and races toward the survivors. Marx and his 8-man crew soon spot survivors in the water. He is stunned to see sharks openly attacking some of the men. 3 life rafts are dropped down to the sailors, but Marx accurately assesses that this will do little good. He can clearly see the wounded men, their arms and faces covered in oil to protect them from the sun, rising and falling on the 12-foot swells. The sharks seem to be ignoring those sailors clustered in groups, instead targeting men who have drifted off alone. Lieutenant Marx knows he must act. Navy regulations prohibit him from landing the Dumbo, as his seaplane is nicknamed, on anything but calm waters. But Marx wants to land anyway. He pulls his crew, knowing that if he crashes, their lives will be on his hands. To a man, they agree to land, despite the fierce seas. On his first pass, the Dumbo bounces off a swell, soaring 15 feet in the air before landing hard in the trough. Immediately, Marx directs his plane across the ocean surface, focusing first on rescuing lone survivors. Each time his plane draws near a man in the water, his crew tosses a life ring attached to ropes, then pulls the man in. Marx and his crew work feverishly. The interior of the plane is soon filled. Word reaches the cockpit that these men are from the Indianapolis, a fact especially poignant to Lieutenant Marx, for he grew up in a small Indiana town close to that city. By nightfall, the courageous work of Marx and his crew has resulted in 56 men being saved. However, the Dumbo will never fly again because of the damage it received on landing in the sea. Instead, it is now a refuge from the sharks and the oil, allowing the men of the Indianapolis to finally get a fitful night of sleep, some of them lashed to the wings with parachute cord. The sea once again turns stormy, and Marx becomes worried that his overloaded aircraft might sink. Scores of badly injured men were softly crying with thirst and with pain, Marx will later recall. And then, far out on the horizon, there was a light. The USS Cecil J. Doyle has arrived. Captain Charles McVeigh and the men in his raft are not among those rescued by Lieutenant Marx or the Cecil J. Doyle. As the sun rises on their 5th day in the water, McVeigh's group can see the rescue operations in the distance, but they despair that they are too far away to be found. On Friday, August 3rd at 11:30 a.m., McVeigh spots another plane. This time, it sees him. An empty metal ammunition can on board his raft has miraculously been picked up by a search ship's radar, and rescue planes are quickly dispatched. After 5 days in the ocean, without a drop of water to drink, Captain Charles McVeigh and the men in his life raft are rescued. More than 800 of his men leapt into the water on the night the USS Indianapolis sank. The tally of survivors is listed as 317 officers and sailors. In actuality, it is one less. 23 years from now, unable to blot out these memories and considering himself to blame for the deaths of nearly 900 men, Captain Charles McVeigh will place his Navy service revolver to his head and pull the trigger. Footnote: just 1 week after his rescue, Captain McVeigh was asked to stand before a board of inquiry into the sinking of the Indianapolis. It was found that McVeigh was at fault because he had stopped the anti-submarine zigzag evasion pattern shortly after nightfall. Admiral Chester Nimitz, commander of all naval forces in the Pacific, opposed a court-martial. However, he was overruled by Navy leaders in Washington. McVeigh was found guilty in 1945, though many of the Indianapolis's surviving crew believed he was made a scapegoat. McVeigh's conviction was later set aside at the request of Admiral Nimitz, and McVeigh retired in 1949 with the rank of Rear Admiral. End footnote. 17. Hiroshima, Japan, August 3, 1945, 7:30 a.m. The angry drone of B-29 bomber engines is not an unusual sound for the people of this densely populated port city. On a heavily overcast morning, air raid sirens once again announce the arrival of the silver behemoths, thundering overhead unopposed at an elevation of 20,000 feet. Since Hiroshima has not been bombed during the war, most citizens think the sirens are just another false alarm. there is no stampede to take refuge in the bomb shelters. But this raid is different. It is rush hour in Hiroshima, and as commuters on their way to work by streetcar, bicycle, and bus can clearly see, bombs are tumbling out of the warplanes, soon to inflict the same horrific damage on Hiroshima that has been visited on almost every other major city in Japan. Until today, this city located at the mouth of the Ota River Delta has been spared, even as B-29 raids have systematically destroyed most of Japan. Major cities like Tokyo were bombed first. Now General Curtis LeMay is directing his bombers towards secondary targets, such as Toyama, a hub for ball-bearing and aluminum production. 4 days ago, 182 B-29s literally leveled Toyama by dropping 1,466 tons of conventional and incendiary bombs on the city. No home or industry was left unpunished, with one estimate showing 99.5% of Toyama wiped off the map. On August 1st, during attacks focusing on Japan's ability to transport men and materiel, the rail hub of Hachioji was obliterated by the Army Air Corps' 58th Bomb Wing. In addition, the 313th Bomb Wing decimated the rail hub of Nagaoka, and the 314th vaporized the tiny rail center of Mito. Since the Tokyo firebombings in March, the full scope of LeMay's aerial attacks has emerged. 1 million Japanese have died in 66 targeted cities. 10 million more have been made homeless. But as the B-29s open their bomb bay doors over Hiroshima this morning, it is not fire that falls from the sky. Instead, unarmed 500-pound canisters hurtle toward the ground. At 4,000 feet, an altitude charge automatically opens them. Hundreds of thousands of 4x8-inch slips of paper known as LeMay bombing leaflets are released into the sky and flutter to the ground. "Civilians," they read in Japanese, "evacuate at once." These leaflets are being dropped to notify you that your city has been listed for destruction by our powerful Air Force. This advance notice will give your military authorities ample time to take necessary defensive measures to protect you from our inevitable attack. Watch and see how powerless they are to protect you. Systematic destruction of city after city will continue as long as you blindly follow your military leaders whose blunders have placed you on the very brink of oblivion. It is your responsibility to overthrow the military government now and save what is left of your beautiful country. In the meanwhile, we encourage all civilians to evacuate at once. 1 week ago at the Potsdam Conference, President Harry Truman issued a simple warning that if Japan did not surrender immediately, it would face prompt and utter destruction, which soon became known as the Potsdam Declaration. Many citizens throughout Japan know of this ultimatum because of American radio broadcasts delivered in Japanese. Footnote: empowered by possession of the atomic bomb and determined to minimize the Soviet Union's role in the post-war Pacific, Harry Truman issued the Potsdam Declaration before showing it to the Russians. Thus, in a diplomatic slap in the face, the Soviets were not allowed to sign the definitive mandate about the ending of the war. They retaliated by accelerating their timetable for the invasion of Manchuria in an attempt to get a toehold in Japanese-held territory before the end of the war. End of footnote. As the leaflets reach the ground, the people of Hiroshima open them to see aerial photographs of 5 B-29s unleashing scores of bombs on Japan. A series of small circles form the border, each representing a city that has been targeted. B-29s have been dropping these leaflets on cities all over Japan for more than a week. By any estimate, Hiroshima is a perfect target. Japanese authorities are so convinced of this that they have already evacuated almost 100,000 citizens to safer locations. Hiroshima is entirely flat and just a few feet above sea level, meaning that an explosion will expand outward with maximum effect. The city is also the headquarters of Japan's Second Army, whose 25,000 soldiers will be vital to thwarting the American invasion. In addition, Hiroshima possesses a massive armament storage depot. It is a thriving port and communications hub, and, as American intelligence was relieved to report on July 30th, not a single Allied prisoner of war is being held within the city's 26 square miles. Footnote. Later reports would find that 8 American POWs were being held in the Hiroshima castle. End of footnote. As American B-29s pass over the city, then out over the Sea of Japan and back to their bases in the Mariana Islands 6 hours from now, the people of Hiroshima are left to wonder what these leaflets really mean. On the island of Tinian, 1,500 miles southeast of Hiroshima, final preparations for the dropping of the atomic bomb are in place. Today, August 3rd, might have seen the B-29 crews release the bomb known as Little Boy instead of warning leaflets, but a typhoon approaching Japan made flying conditions less than ideal. Little Boy has been ready to go for 3 days. The 5-ton explosive device rests on a special trailer, covered in canvas to conceal its appearance. All Little Boy lacks to be activated are the 4 cordite charges that will initiate the explosion. These will not be secured in the bomb until the B-29 carrying it to Hiroshima has taken off, just in case the plane crashes on the runway. The pilot flying the bombing mission is Colonel Paul W. Tibbetts, a 30-year-old career officer from Quincy, Illinois. During the early part of the war, he served as the personal pilot for General George S. Patton in Europe. As part of his assignment, Tibbetts also went on to fly more than 40 combat missions over the Third Reich. He has been flying the B-29 since its debut in 1943. At this moment, the aircraft he will fly has no catchy name, no artwork emblazoned across its nose. Right now, it is only known by the number painted on its fuselage, 82. Tibbetts was personally selected by General Leslie Groves to lead the elite detachment of pilots who will drop atomic weapons on Japan. He has been practicing the bombing for weeks, flying out over the Pacific with a dummy version of Little Boy and dropping it in the ocean. Now Tibbetts is waiting on the weather. The skies have to be clear enough over Hiroshima for him to visually see his target and deploy the bomb. The final word will come from General Curtis LeMay, who will then inform Washington that he has given the order for Tibbetts to take off. Firm decision is expected from LeMay at 4 August 0400, reads a top-secret classified telegram to the War Department. Colonel Tibbetts knows it is almost time. The actual and forecast weather were almost identical, he will later remember. So we got busy. In Tokyo, Emperor Hirohito is not concerned. The words prompt and utter destruction delivered by President Harry Truman have not resonated with the emperor. Like his prime minister, Kentaro Suzuki, he believes those words to be recycled rhetoric from previous meetings among Allied leaders. So he ignores Truman's ultimatum, still believing that the Soviet Union will help broker a peace to his liking with the West, completely oblivious to the fact that Russian leader Joseph Stalin is just 5 days away from invading Japanese-held Manchuria. At a point when Hirohito's nation desperately needs him to show wisdom and discretion, the emperor is behaving like a deluded fool. Meanwhile, a joint session of Hirohito's cabinet and the Supreme Council for the Direction of the War is in session. Their topic of debate is whether or not any surrender is permissible. They have argued the matter for more than a week with no conclusion in sight. Like their divine emperor, this assemblage of politicians and military leaders believes that President Harry Truman will not follow through on his demand of unconditional surrender. Time, they believe, is on their side. In a statement to the world's media on July 28th, the Japanese formally reject any notion that they will accede to Truman's demands. Later that day, Japanese Prime Minister Kentaro Suzuki holds a press conference to reiterate those statements, saying that the only alternative for us is to be determined to continue our fight to the end. Joining their emperor in delusion, the Japanese leadership believes they still control their destiny. As Navy Minister Mitsumasa Yonai states about Truman's promise of total annihilation, America is beginning to be isolated. The government, therefore, will ignore it. There is no need to rush. 18. North Field, Tinian, Mariana Islands, August 4th, 1945, 1500 hours. Colonel Paul Warfield Tibbetts, Jr. is always on time. Cradling a Kay Woody briar pipe in his left hand, the commander of America's nuclear strike force strides past a cordon of armed guards, hurrying into the Quonset hut that will serve as today's briefing room. Tibbetts is obsessively punctual, and today is no exception. The meeting is due to start at precisely 3 p.m. As he pushes into the crowded room, he is not a second late. At 30 years of age, Tibbetts, raised in Illinois, Iowa, and Florida, is short, compact, and very young for the advanced rank of full colonel. His hair is cut short per military regulations, but everything else about his appearance suggests a man with a strong streak of individuality. That thick, dark hair is uncombed. A tuft of chest hair fluffs out of the unbuttoned collar of his wrinkled khaki uniform shirt. And, somewhat incongruously for such a vital mission, Tibbetts wears shorts on this hot Saturday afternoon, making the moment appear almost casual. Tibbetts surveils a packed room as he takes his place on the briefing platform. A photographer captures the moment on film. Each B-29 requires a crew of 11 men. Footnote: a crew consists of the aircraft commander, co-pilot, navigator, bombardier, electronics countermeasures officer, tail gunner, flight engineer, assistant flight engineer, ordnance expert, and two radar operators. Tibbetts will also carry a 12th crew member on the Hiroshima mission as weaponeer, in charge of arming the bomb. End footnote. 7 aircraft are now being readied for flight. The crews, all in lightweight khaki uniforms, sit on hard wooden chairs. Tibbetts hand-picked these men. All are in their 20s and 30s. They are the best of the best, soon to fly a world-changing mission over what they refer to as the Empire. Tibbetts does not mince words. The moment has arrived. This is what we have all been working toward. Very recently, the weapon we are about to deliver was successfully tested in the United States. We have received orders to drop it on the enemy. Behind Tibbetts are 2 blackboards covered by thick cloth. 2 intelligence officers step forward and remove the drapes, revealing maps of Hiroshima, Kokura, and Nagasaki. Tibbetts states that these are the intended targets. Footnote: Niigata was ultimately removed from the list of bombing sites. Its location in northwest Honshu was too far from Tinian, allowing little room for error in terms of fuel for the B-29s. End of footnote. He then breaks down each crew's responsibilities. Captain Charles McKnight, in the B-29 named Top Secret, will fly to Iwo Jima and remain there as a backup in case of emergency. Major Ralph Taylor Jr.'s Full House, Captain Claude Etherly's Straight Flush, and Major John Wilson's Jabot 3 will fly over Japan the day prior to the bombing to check the weather. Necessary Evil, piloted by Captain George Marquardt, will photograph the explosion, and Major Charles Sweeney's The Great Artiste will measure the blast by dropping scientific instruments that will float to the ground by parachute and then radio details back to Guam and Tinian. Tibbetts will pilot the lead plane containing the A-bomb. As of now, the aircraft has no nickname. Since the 509th Composite Group was activated in December 1944, these crews have trained in utter secrecy. They are not popular here in Tinian, where other bomber squadrons mock their many privileges and top-secret compound. But they ignore the taunts, knowing that they have been training for a high-level mission that could end the war. Tibbetts was given 15 B-29s and a top-secret training location in the Utah desert. Once the crews Tibbetts handpicked flew to Tinian a month ago, they began simulating a most unique sort of bombing mission. Instead of dozens of bombs, they practiced dropping just 1 rotund pumpkin bomb. At 5 tons, 12 feet in length, and 5 feet in diameter, the pumpkin bomb approximated the size of the atomic bomb known as Fat Man. This allowed pilots to get a feel for how the actual bomb will fall as it is deployed from their forward bomb bay. Little Boy is a different shape from Fat Man, measuring 10 feet long and just a bit more than 2 feet in diameter. the men of the 509th successfully drop-tested a non-atomic replica of Little Boy on July 23rd. Tibbetts calls 43-year-old Navy officer William S. Deke Parsons to the platform. An ordnance expert by training, Captain Parsons has served in a most unique capacity during the war, spending much of his time at Los Alamos, where he worked not only with Robert Oppenheimer on the design and development of Little Boy, but also with General Groves on the target committee. He even observed the Trinity explosion less than a month ago. Since then, Parsons has been Little Boy's constant companion, overseeing its delivery to Tinian. It was Parsons who personally met with Captain Charles McVeigh of the USS Indianapolis in San Francisco to convey the order that his ship will sail at high speed to Tinian with the bomb components. Throughout his 2 years in Los Alamos, Captain Parsons' primary motivation for designing the bomb has been to end the war. This ambition became personal shortly after the Indianapolis set sail from San Francisco, when Parsons made a rapid detour to see his young half-brother in a San Diego naval hospital. Bob Parsons was among the 20,000 American casualties during the fierce fighting on Iwo Jima. Once handsome, the Marine Corps private's face is now permanently disfigured. The right side caved in, his jaw gone, a pink prosthesis in the orb where his right eye once rested. Deke Parsons knows he can do little to help his younger brother, but believes dropping the A-bomb will prevent the same thing from happening to other young American men. At the podium, Captain Parsons looks at the faces of the aviators gathered in this stuffy Quonset hut and tells them all about the weapon that will win the war. "The bomb you are about to drop is something new in the history of warfare," Parsons begins. "It is the most destructive weapon ever produced." Parsons then tells the men about the Trinity Blast, an explosion 10 times more brilliant than the sun. Following orders to keep the source of the detonation a secret, he does not use the words atomic or nuclear. Footnote: only Tibbetts, Parsons, and Bombardier Major Thomas W. Farabee are allowed to know that the bomb to be dropped on Hiroshima is atomic. End footnote. Instead, he draws a picture of the enormous mushroom cloud in chalk on a blackboard, describing how the cloud vacuumed sand up off the desert floor and carried it thousands of feet into the air. "We think it will knock out everything within a 3-mile area," Parsons tells the men, adding that Little Boy might be even more powerful than the Trinity explosion. "No one knows what will happen when the bomb is dropped from the air." The B-29 crewmen are stunned. Such a weapon is beyond their comprehension. Tibbetts once again takes his place on the briefing platform. "Whatever any of us, including myself, has done until now is small potatoes compared to what we are going to do," he tells his men. "I'm proud to be associated with you. Your morale has been high, even though it was difficult not knowing what you were doing, thinking that maybe you were wasting your time and that the gimmick was just somebody's wild dream. I am personally honored, and I'm sure all of you are too, to take part in this raid, which will shorten the war by at least 6 months." Tibbetts gazes out over the room one last time. "Depending on the weather, this mission will go off on August 6th. Footnote: Tibbetts' speech is paraphrased, taken from an illegal diary of the meeting kept by radio operator Sergeant Abe Spitzer. End footnote. 19. Hiroshima, Japan, August 5th, 1945, 11 p.m. It is bedtime on this Sunday night. Throughout Hiroshima, citizens rest up for the coming work week. In the city's Ujina district, 32-year-old firefighter Yosaku Mikami is well past the halfway point of his 24-hour shift. If all goes well, he will sleep through the night before getting off work at 8 a.m. Then Mikami will ride by streetcar to his house on the edge of town in the Sakeyamachi district, heading in the opposite direction of commuters traveling to their places of work in the city. Most mornings, Mikami returns home to the smell of breakfast being cooked over burning coals in a hibachi. His wife greets him warmly as his 2 young children prepare for school. But the morning of August 6, 1945, will be different. Many in Hiroshima use the word bukimi, strange or otherworldly, to describe the uneasy awareness in recent days that the Americans have not leveled their city. Some predict, with grisly humor, that it is only a matter of time before their luck runs out. As a firefighter, Mikami approves of the firebreaks being cleared throughout Hiroshima, wide open areas in the middle of the city where wooden homes and buildings have been knocked down and the rubble removed to prevent fire racing from house to house, as it did during the Tokyo firebombings of March 1944. Mikami is saddened and relieved at the same time by precautions that civil authorities are taking to spare women and young children. Thousands are being evacuated to the countryside. Among them are Mikami's wife and children, who departed just this morning. Their final destination is uncertain right now. If relatives will not take them in, they will be forced to sleep in temples or public halls along with the thousands of other Japanese citizens being sent away for their own safety. Tomorrow morning will be lonely for Yosaku Mikami, for he will walk into his empty home and begin to think about this missing family. Air raid sirens suddenly awake 16-year-old Akira Onogi inside his family's home, adjacent to a small warehouse. The sound has become a regular part of many nights, often the result of American bombers flying overhead en route to other targets. Thus, Akira feels no rush to go to an air raid shelter. Japan's 1937 air defense law was created for a night like this, but the long war and the reluctance of America to bomb Hiroshima have desensitized its residents. A second siren signaling a false alarm means that all is clear. On the other hand, the unmistakable thunder of an approaching B-29 bomb squadron means young and old alike must immediately get to an air raid shelter. Despite the risk, Akira and the other four members of his family prefer to remain comfortably in bed. Tonight, 588 B-29s are attacking five target cities throughout Japan, though Hiroshima will not be one of them. Not a single plane will be shot down. The Americans, it seems, can bomb wherever they want, whenever they want, and whatever they want. Soon enough comes the all clear. Akira rolls over and goes back to sleep. Though in his second year of junior high school and an avid student, Akira is no longer allowed to attend classes. Instead, like his fellow students, he has been mobilized to aid the war effort by laboring in the factories. He is due to rise early for work at the Mitsubishi shipbuilding plant. It is his patriotic obligation, but not a job that he enjoys. The August night is pitch black but warm. The only sound Akira hears is that of light snoring from his parents. But the boy is not worried that his rest is being disturbed, for he has made other plans for the morning of Monday, August 6th. In a minor act of protest, he plans to stay home from work and read a book. Little does Akira know that he will soon play a role in a real-life story beyond anything the written word can accurately describe. Akiko Takakura needs to be up early on Monday. Someday she hopes to be a preschool teacher, but for now the 20-year-old is a bank employee. In the morning, she will eat her breakfast of breakfast corn, soybean draft, and rice before taking the streetcar to the Hachoburi station and then walking to her job at the Gaibi Bank. It will be the height of rush hour, the streets teeming with commuters, but it will also be a lovely stroll enhanced by views of the Ota River, the parade ground where Japanese soldiers perform their morning calisthenics, and Hiroshima Castle, a revered local landmark dating back to the 16th century. If all goes well, Akiko will climb the 9 stone steps to the double doors leading into the 3-story Gaibi Bank building by 8:15 a.m. The bank is built of stone and features protective armored shutters on the first and second floors to deter robbers. Female employees must arrive at work 30 minutes before the men in order to clean the office space, so once inside, Akiko will stamp the bank's attendance log and then step behind the teller windows to begin the dusting of desks and other minor organizational tasks that form the start of her workday routine. She is a model employee. Her superiors appreciate that she likes to arrive early for work. It is a trait that will soon save her life. After the Trinity A-bomb test took place in the New Mexico desert 3 weeks ago, British physicist William Penny of the Manhattan Project measured the blast and reported that another such explosion would reduce a city of 300,000 or 400,000 people to nothing but a sink for disaster relief, bandages, and hospitals. The force of the test explosion was equivalent to 10,000 tons of dynamite. A brilliant fireball was followed by a purple cloud glowing with radioactivity that soared into the stratosphere. Everything within the blast zone was vaporized. If a man had been standing within that zone, he would have died in a fraction of a second, but not before his bone marrow boiled and his flesh literally exploded from his skeleton. In the next millisecond, nothing of that person would remain except compressed gas, which would be instantly sucked up into that great purple cloud racing high into the sky. The Trinity A-bomb test killed no one. But now a new chapter of warfare is about to begin.